No politics.
How about football?
Cobb asked.
And no football,
Myra said with a smile.
Bruce, what would you like to talk about?
Politics and football,
Bruce said, and everyone laughed.
What's happening at the store this week?
Well, Wednesday, Serena Roach is back. I expect to see you all at the store for the signing.
She got trashed in the Times this morning,
Amy said with a hint of satisfaction.
Did y'all see it?
Who reads the Times?
Cobb asked.
Left-wing garbage.
I'd love to be trashed in the Times, or anywhere else for that matter,
Lee said.
What's her book about?
It's her fourth novel, and it's about a single woman in New York City who's having relationship problems.
How original, Andy blurted. Can't wait to read that one.
He drained his second double vodka and asked Dora for another. Myra frowned at Bruce, who shrugged as if to say,
He's a grown man.
Gazpacho,
Myra said as she picked up her spoon.
Dig in!
Within seconds, they were all chatting at once as separate conversations spun off. Cobb and Andy quietly discussed politics. Lee and Jay huddled at the end of the table and talked about someone's novel. Myra and Amy were curious about a new restaurant. And in a soft voice, Bruce said to Mercer,
I'm sorry I brought up Tess's death.
It was quite rude.
No, it wasn't, she said. It was a long time ago.
I knew Porter well. He was a regular at the store, loved detective stories. Tessa dropped in once a year, but didn't buy a lot of books. Seems like I vaguely remember a granddaughter many years ago.
How long are you here?
Noelle asked. Mercer was confident that everything she had told Myra had already been relayed to Bruce.
A few months.
I'm between jobs, or I should say that I'm out of work. For the past 3 years I've been teaching, but I hope that's behind me. And you? Tell me about your store.
I sell French antiques. I have a shop next door to the bookstore. I'm from New Orleans, but I met Bruce and moved here. Just after Katrina.
Soft, clear, perfect diction with no trace of New Orleans. No trace of anything. And no wedding ring, but plenty of jewelry.
Mercer said, That was 2005, a month after Tessa's accident. I remember it well.
Bruce asked,
Were you here when it happened?
No, that was the first summer in 14 years that I did not spend here. I had to get a job to pay for college, and I was working in Memphis, my hometown.
Dora was removing the bowls and pouring more wine. Andy was getting louder.
Do you have children?
Mercer asked. Both Bruce and Noelle smiled and shook their heads.
We've never had the time, she said.
I travel a lot, buying and selling, mainly to France. And Bruce is at the store 7 days a week.
You don't go with her?
Mercer asked Bruce.
Not very often. We were married there.
No, you weren't. It was such an easy, casual lie. One they had been living for a long time. Mercer took a sip of wine and reminded herself that she was sitting next to one of the most successful dealers of stolen rare books in the country. As they talked about the south of France and the antiques trade there, Mercer wondered how much Noel knew about his business. If he had really paid $1 million for the Fitzgerald manuscripts, surely she would know it. Right? He was not a tycoon with interests around the world and ways to move and hide money. He was a small-town bookseller who practically lived in his store. He couldn't hide that much money from her, could he? Noel had to know. Bruce admired October Rain and was curious about the abrupt end to Mercer's first book tour. Myra overheard this and called for quiet as she prompted Mercer to tell her story. While Dora served baked pompano, the conversation settled on the topic of book tours, and everyone had a story. Lee, Jay, and Cobb confessed that they too had wasted an hour or two in the back of stores selling zero copies. Andy drew small crowds with his first book and, not surprisingly, was kicked out of a bookstore when he got drunk and insulted customers who wouldn't buy it. Even Amy, the bestseller, had a few bad days before she discovered vampires. During dinner, Andy switched to ice water, and the entire table seemed to relax. Cobb got wound up with a story from prison. It was about an 18-year-old kid who was sexually abused by his cellmate, a real predator. Years later, after both had been paroled, The kid tracked down his old cellie, found him living the quiet life in the suburbs, his past forgotten. Time for revenge. It was a long, interesting story, and when Cobb finished, Andy said,
"What a crock. Pure fiction, right? That's your next novel."
"No, I swear it's true."
"Bullshit. You've done this before. Regaled us with a tall tale to see how we react to it, then a year later it's a novel."
"Well, I have thought about it. What do you think? Commercial enough?"
"I like it," Bruce said. "But go easy on the prison rape scenes. You've overplayed those a bit, I think."
"You sound like my agent,"
Cobb mumbled. He pulled a pen out of his shirt pocket as if he needed to start taking notes.
"Anything else? Mercer, what do you think?"
"I get a vote?"
"Sure, why not? Your vote will mean as much as the rest of these hacks."
"I might use the story," Andy said, and everyone laughed.
"Well, you damn sure need a good story. Did you make your deadline?"
"Yes. I've sent it in, and they've already sent it back. Structural problems.
Same as your last book, but they published it anyway."
"And a good move on their part. They couldn't print them fast enough."
"Now, boys," Myra said, "you're breaking the first rule. No talking about your own books."
"This could go on all night,"
Bruce whispered to Mercer, just loud enough for the rest to hear. She loved the bantering, as they all did. She had never been with a group of writers so eager to jab each other, but all in fun. Amy, whose cheeks were red from the wine, said,
"What if the kid from prison is really a vampire?"
The table erupted with even more laughter. Cobb quickly replied,
"Hey, I hadn't thought about that. We could start a new series about vampires in prison. I like it. You want to collaborate?"
Amy said,
"I'll get my agent to call your agent, see if they can work something out."
With perfect timing, Lee said,
"And you wonder why books are declining."
When the laughter died, Cobb said,
"Once again, shot down by the literary mafia."
Things were quieter for a few minutes as they worked on dinner. Cobb started chuckling and said,
"Structural problems. What does that mean?"
"Means the plot sucks, which it does. I never really felt that good about it, frankly."
"You could always self-publish it, you know. Bruce will put it on that folding card table in the back of the store, his own slush pile."
Bruce replied,
"Please, that table is full."
Myra changed the subject by asking,
"So, Mercer, you've been here a few days. Can we ask how the writing is going?"
"That's a bad question," Mercer replied with a smile.
"Are you trying to finish a book or start one?"
"I'm not sure," she said.
"The current one will probably get tossed, then I'll start a new one. I'm still undecided."
"Well, if you need any advice whatsoever about any aspect of writing or publishing or romance or relationships, food, wine, travel, politics, anything under the sun, you've come to the right place. Just look around this table. Experts everywhere."
"So I gather."
5. At midnight, Mercer was sitting on the bottom step of the boardwalk, her bare feet in the sand, the waves rolling in. She would never tire of the sound of the ocean, the gentle breaking of the waves with a calm sea, or the crashing surf in a storm. Tonight there was no wind and the tide was low. A lone figure walked south in the distance at the edge of the water. She was still amused by the dinner and tried to remember as much as possible. The more she thought, the more astonishing it became. A room filled with writers with their insecurities and egos and jealousies, and with wine flowing, and not a single argument, not even a harsh word. The popular authors, Amy, Cobb, and Andy, longed for critical acclaim, while the literary ones, Lee, Jay, and Mercer, longed for greater royalties. Myra didn't give a damn one way or the other. Bruce and Noel were content to stay in the middle and encourage them all. She wasn't sure what to make of Bruce. The first impression was quite good, but given his good looks and easygoing manner, Mercer was certain that everyone liked Bruce, at least initially. He talked enough, but not too much, and seemed content to allow Myra to be in charge. It was, after all, her party, and she obviously knew what she was doing. He was completely at ease with his crowd and thoroughly enjoyed their stories, jokes, cheap shots, and insults. Mercer got the impression he would do anything to further their careers. They, in turn, were almost deferential to him. He claimed to be an admirer of Mercer's two books, especially her novel, and they talked about it enough to satisfy her doubts about whether he had actually read it. He said he had done so when it was published and she had been scheduled to sign at Bay Books. That had been 7 years earlier, yet he remembered it well. He'd probably skimmed it before the dinner party, but Mercer was impressed nonetheless. He asked her to stop by the store and autograph the two copies in his collection. He had also read her book of short stories. Most important, he was eager to see something else, her next novel, perhaps, or more stories. For Mercer, a once promising writer suffering through an endless drought and handcuffed by the fear that her career might be over, it was comforting to have such a knowledgeable reader say nice things and want more. Over the past few years, only her agent and her editor had offered such encouragement. He was certainly a charmer, but he said or did nothing out of line. Not that she expected anything. His lovely wife was just inches away. When it came to seduction, and assuming the rumors were true, Mercer suspected that Bruce Cable could play the long game as well as the short one. Several times during the dinner, she looked across the table at Cobb and Amy and even Myra, and wondered if they had any idea about his dark side. Up front, he ran one of the finest bookstores in the country, while at the same time he dealt in stolen goods under deep cover. The bookstore was successful and made him plenty of money. He had a charmed life, a beautiful wife/partner, a fine reputation, and a historic mansion in a lovely town. Was he really willing to risk jail for trading in stolen manuscripts? Did he have any clue that a professional security team was on his trail, with the FBI not far behind? Any inkling that in just a few months he might be headed to prison for many years? No, it did not seem possible. Did he suspect Mercer? No, he did not. Which brought up the obvious question about what to do next. Take it one day at a time, Elaine had said more than once. Make him come to you and ease your way into his life. Sounds simple, right? 6. Monday, Memorial Day. Mercer slept late and missed another sunrise. She poured coffee and went to the beach, which was busier because of the holiday, but still not crowded. After a long walk, she returned to the cottage, poured more coffee, and took a seat at a small breakfast table with a view of the ocean. She opened her laptop, looked at a blank screen, and managed to type, Chapter 1. Writers are generally split into two camps, those who carefully outline their stories and know the ending before they begin, and those who refuse to do so upon the theory that once a character is created, he or she will do something interesting. The old novel, the one she had just discarded, the one that had tortured her for the past 5 years, fell into the second category. After 5 years, nothing of interest had happened, and she was sick of the characters. Let it go, she had decided. Let it rest. You can always come back to it. She wrote a rough summary of the first chapter of her new one, and went to the second. By noon, she had ground her way through the first 5 chapter summaries and was exhausted. 7. Traffic was slow along Main Street, and its sidewalks were crawling with tourists in town for the holiday weekend. Mercer parked on a side street and walked to the bookstore. She managed to avoid Bruce and went to the upstairs cafe, where she had a sandwich and scanned the Times. He walked past her to fetch an espresso and was surprised to see her.
You have time to sign those books?
He asked. That's why I'm here. She followed him downstairs to the first editions room, where he closed the door behind them. Two large windows opened onto the first floor, and customers browsed through racks of books not far away. In the center of the room was an old table covered with papers and files. Is this your office? She asked.
One of them. When things are slow, I'll ease in here and work a little.
When are things slow?
It's a bookstore. Today it's busy. Tomorrow it'll be deserted.
He moved a catalog that was hiding two hardback copies of October Rain. He handed her a pen and picked up the books. She said, "I haven't autographed one of these in a long time." He opened the first one to the title page and she scribbled her name, then did the same for the other one. He left one on the table and put one back into its slot on a shelf. The first editions were arranged in alphabetical order by the author's last name. "So what are these?" she asked, waving a hand at a wall of books.
"All first editions of writers who've signed here. We do about 100 signings a year, so after 20 years, it's a nice collection. I checked the records, and when you were coming through on tour, I ordered 120 copies.
120? Why so many?
I have a first editions club. About 100 of my top customers who buy every autographed book. It's quite a draw, really. If I can guarantee 100 books, the publishers and writers are pretty eager to put us on the tour.
And these people show up for every signing?
I wish. Usually about half, which makes for a nice crowd. 30% live out of town and collect by mail.
What happened when I canceled?
I returned the books.
Sorry about that.
Just part of the business.
Mercer moved along the wall, scanning the rows of books, some of which she recognized. All were single copies. Where were the others? He had put one of hers back and left one on the table. Where were they kept? So, are any of these valuable? She asked.
Not really. It's an impressive collection, and it means a lot to me because I'm attached to each one of them. But they rarely hold their value.
Why is that?
The first-run printings are too large. The first printing for your book was 5,000 copies. That's not huge, but to be valuable, a book has to be scarce. Sometimes I get lucky, though.
He reached high, removed a book, and handed it to her.
Remember Drunk in Philly? J.P. Walthall's masterpiece.
Of course.
Won the National Book Award and the Pulitzer in 1999.
I read it in college.
I saw an advanced reading copy and loved it. Knew it had potential. So I ordered a few boxes, and that was before he said he would not be touring. His publisher was broke and not too sharp to begin with, so it did an initial run of 6,000 copies. Not bad for a first novel, but not nearly enough. Well, the printing got interrupted when the union went on strike. Only 1,200 copies made it off the press before they shut it down. I got lucky when my supply arrived. The first reviews were insanely good, and the second printing, at a different press, was 20,000. Double that for the third, and so on. The book eventually sold 1,000,000 copies in hardback.
Mercer opened the book, flipped to the copyright page, and saw the words, First Edition. So what's this worth? She asked.
I've sold a couple at $5,000. Now I'm asking $8,000. Still have about 25 of them buried in the basement.
She filed that away, but said nothing. She handed the book back to him and walked to another wall covered with books.
Bruce said, "More of the collection, but not all of those authors have signed here."
She removed John Irving's The Cider House Rules and said, "I'm assuming there are plenty of these on the market."
"It's John Irving. That was 7 years after Garp, so the first printing was huge. It's worth a few $100. I have one Garp, but it's not for sale."
She returned the book to its slot and quickly scanned the ones next to it. Garp was not there. She assumed it, too, was buried in the basement, but said nothing. She wanted to ask about his rarest books, but decided to lose interest.
"Did you enjoy dinner last night?"
he asked. She laughed and moved away from the shelves.
"Oh, yes. I've never had dinner with so many writers. We tend to keep to ourselves, you know."
"I know. In your honor, everybody behaved. Believe me, it's not always that civilized."
"And why is that?"
"The nature of the breed. Mixed together some fragile egos, booze, maybe some politics, and it usually gets rowdier."
"I can't wait. When's the next party?"
"Who knows with that bunch? Noelle mentioned a dinner party in a couple of weeks. She enjoyed your company."
"Same here. She's lovely."
"She's a lot of fun, and she's very good at what she does. You should pop in her store and have a look."
"I'll do that.
though I'm not in the market for the high-end stuff.
He laughed and said,
Well, watch out. She's very proud of her inventory.
I'm meeting Serena Roach for coffee tomorrow before the signing.
You've met her?
Sure, she's been here twice.
She's pretty intense, but nice enough.
She tours with her boyfriend and her publicist.
An entourage?
I suppose. It's not that unusual. She has battled drugs and appears to be somewhat fragile. Life on the road is unsettling for a lot of riders, and they need the security.
She can't travel by herself?
Bruce laughed and seemed hesitant to gossip.
I could tell you a lot of stories, okay? Some sad, some hilarious, all colorful. Let's save them for another day, perhaps another long dinner.
Is it the same boyfriend? The reason I ask is that I'm reading her latest, and her character struggles with men as well as drugs. The author seems to know her material.
Don't know, but on her last two tours, she had the same boyfriend.
Poor girl is getting roughed up by the critics.
Yes, and she's not handling it too well. Her publicist called this morning to make sure I don't mention dinner afterward. They're trying to keep her away from the wine bottle.
And the tour is just starting?
We're the third stop. Could be another disaster. I guess she could always quit, like you.
I highly recommend it. A clerk stuck her head in the window and said, Sorry to disturb, but Scott Turow is on the phone.
I'd better take that, he said.
See you tomorrow,
Mercer said, and walked to the door.
Thanks for signing the books.
I'll sign all of my books you buy.
8. 3 days later, Mercer waited until dusk and walked to the beach. She removed her sandals and put them into a small shoulder bag. She headed south along the water's edge. The tide was low, the beach wide and deserted but for an occasional couple with their dog. 20 minutes later, she passed a row of high-rise condos and headed for the Ritz-Carlton next door. At the boardwalk, she rinsed her feet, put on the sandals, strolled by the empty pool, and went inside, where she found Elaine waiting at a table in the elegant bar. Tessa had loved the Ritz bar. 2 or 3 times each summer, she and Mercer dressed in their finest and drove to the Ritz, first for drinks, and then dinner at the hotel's noted restaurant. Tessa always started with a martini, just one, and until she was 15, Mercer ordered a diet soda. When she was 15, though, she arrived for the summer with a fake ID, and they had martinis together. By chance, Elaine was sitting at their favorite table, and as Mercer sat down, she was hit hard with the memories of her grandmother. Nothing had changed. A guy at the piano was singing softly in the background.
I got in this afternoon and thought you might enjoy a fine dinner, Elaine said.
I've been here many times, Mercer said, looking around, soaking in the same smells of salt air and oak paneling. My grandmother adored this place. It's not for those on a tight budget, but she splurged occasionally.
So Tessa didn't have money?
No, she was comfortable, but she was also frugal. Let's talk about something else. A waiter stopped by and they ordered drinks. Elaine said,
I'd say you've had a pretty good week.
Their routine included the nightly email as Mercer recapped things that might be relevant to their search.
I'm not sure I know much more than I did when I got here, but I have made contact with the enemy.
And?
And he's as charming as advertised. Very likable.
He stores the good stuff in the basement, but did not mention a vault. I get the impression there's quite an inventory down there. His wife is in town, and he's done nothing to indicate he has any interest in me, other than his usual attraction to riders.
You have to tell me about the dinner party with Myra and Lee.
Mercer smiled and said, I wish there had been a hidden camera.
Chapter 5. The Facilitator.
1. For over 60 years, the old Boston bookshop had occupied the same row house on West Street in the Ladder Blocks section of downtown. It was founded by Lloyd Stein, a noted antiquarian dealer, and when he died in 1990, his son Oscar took over. Oscar grew up in the store and loved the business, though with time had grown weary of the trade. With the internet and with the general decline in all things related to books,
He had found it more and more difficult to make a decent profit. His father had been content to peddle used books and hope for the occasional big score with a rare one, but Oscar was losing patience. At the age of 58, he was quietly looking for a way out. At 4 o'clock on a Thursday afternoon, Denny entered the store for the third consecutive day and browsed nonchalantly through the racks and piles of used books. When the clerk, an elderly lady who had been there for decades, left the front and went upstairs, Denny selected an old paperback copy of The Great Gatsby and took it to the register. Oscar smiled and asked,
"Find what you're looking for?"
"This will do," Denny replied. Oscar took the book, opened it to the inside cover, and said,
$4.30.
Denny laid a $5 on the counter and said,
"Actually, I'm looking for the original."
Oscar took the $5 and asked,
"You mean a first edition of Gatsby?"
"No, the original manuscript."
Oscar laughed. "What an idiot.
I'm afraid I can't help you there, sir."
"Oh, I think you can."
Oscar froze and looked him in the eyes. A cold, hard stare met him. A hard, calculated, knowing stare. Oscar swallowed and asked,
"Who are you?" "You'll never know."
Oscar looked away and put the $5 in the register. As he did, he realized his hands were shaking. He removed some coins and placed them on the counter.
$0.70,
he managed to say.
"You were here yesterday, weren't you?"
"And the day before."
Oscar looked around. They were indeed alone. He glanced at the small surveillance camera high above, aimed at the register. Denny said quietly,
"Don't worry about the camera. I disabled it last night. And the one in your office isn't working either."
Oscar took a deep breath as his shoulders slumped. After he had spent months living in fear and losing sleep and peeking around corners, the dreaded moment had finally arrived. He asked in a low, shaky voice,
"Are you a cop?"
"No. I'm avoiding cops these days, same as you."
"What do you want?"
"The manuscripts. All $5.
"I don't know what you're talking about."
"Is that the best you can do? I was hoping for something a bit more original."
"Get out of here,"
Oscar hissed, trying to sound as tough as possible.
"I'm leaving. I'll be back at 6 when you close. You'll lock the door and we'll retire to your office for a little chat. I strongly suggest you play it cool. You have nowhere to run and there's no one who can help you. And we're watching."
Denny picked up the coins and the paperback and left the store. 2. An hour later, a lawyer named Ron Jasek stepped onto an elevator in the federal building in Trenton, New Jersey, and pushed the button to the ground floor. At the last second, a stranger slid through the doors and pushed the button to the third floor. As soon as the doors closed and they were alone, the stranger said,
"You represent Jerry Steengarten, right? Court appointed?"
Jasek sneered and said,
"Who the hell are you?"
In a flash, the stranger slapped Jasek across the face, knocking off his glasses. With an iron grip, he grabbed Jasek's throat and rammed his head against the back wall of the elevator.
"Don't talk to me like that. A message for your client. One wrong word to the FBI and people will get hurt. We know where his mother lives, and we know where your mother lives, too."
Jasek's eyes bulged as he dropped his briefcase. He grabbed the stranger's arm, but the death grip just got tighter. Jasek was almost 60 years old and out of shape. The guy with the grip was at least 20 years younger and at that moment seemed incredibly strong. He growled,
"Am I clear? Do you understand?"
The elevator stopped at the third floor, and as the door opened, the stranger let go and shoved Jasek into a corner where he fell to his knees. The stranger walked past him and left as if nothing had happened. No one was waiting to get on, and Jasek quickly got to his feet, found his glasses, picked up his briefcase, and considered his options. His jaw stung and his ears were ringing, and his first thought was to call the police and report the assault. There were federal marshals in the lobby, and maybe he could wait there with them until his assailant emerged. On the way down, though, he decided it might be best not to overreact. By the time he reached the ground floor, he was breathing again. He found a restroom and splashed water on his face and looked at himself. The right side of his face was red, but not swollen. The physical sensation of taking such a blow was stunning and painful. He felt something warm in his mouth and spat blood into the sink. He had not spoken to Jerry Steengarden in over a month. They had little to discuss. Their meetings were always brief because Jerry had nothing to say. The stranger who had just slapped and threatened him had little to worry about. 3. A few minutes before 6, Denny returned to the bookshop and found Oscar waiting nervously at the front counter. The clerk was gone, as were the customers. Without a word, Denny flipped the open-closed sign, locked the door, and turned off the lights. They climbed the stairs to the small, cluttered office where Oscar preferred to spend his days while someone else managed the front. He took his seat behind the desk and waved at the only chair not covered with magazines. Denny sat down and began with,
"Let's not waste any time here, Oscar. I know you bought the manuscripts for $500,000. You wired the money to an account in the Bahamas. From there it went to an account in Panama, and that's where I picked it up. Minus, of course, the percentage for our facilitator."
"So you're the thief?" Oscar said calmly. With some pills, he had managed to settle his nerves.
"I'm not saying that." "How do I know you're not a cop wearing a wire?"
Oscar asked.
"You want to frisk me? Go ahead. How would a cop know the price? How would a cop know the details of the money trail?
I'm sure the FBI can track anything."
"If they knew what I know, they would simply arrest you, Oscar. Relax, you're not going to get arrested, nor am I. You see, Oscar, I can't go to the cops, and you can't either. We're both guilty as hell and looking at a long spell in a federal pen. But it's not going to happen."
Oscar wanted to believe him and was somewhat relieved. However, it was obvious there were a few immediate challenges. He took a deep breath and said,
"I don't have them." "Then where are they? Why did you sell them?"
Denny crossed his legs and relaxed in the old chair.
"I got spooked. The FBI grabbed two of my friends the day after the theft. I had to hide the treasure and skip the country. I waited a month, then two. When things settled down, I came back and went to see a dealer in San Francisco. He said he knew a buyer, a Russian, who would pay $10 million. He was lying. He went to the FBI. We had a meeting scheduled, and I was supposed to deliver one manuscript as proof, but the FBI was waiting."
"How did you know?"
"Because we tapped his phones before we went in. We're very good, Oscar, very patient, very professional. It was a close call, and we left the country again so things could cool off. I knew the FBI had a good description of me, so I stayed out of the country."
"Are my phones tapped?"
Denny nodded and smiled.
"Your landlines. We couldn't hack your cell phone."
"So, how did you find me?"
"I went to Georgetown and eventually made contact with Joel Rybakov, your old pal, our facilitator. I didn't trust him. Who can you trust in this business? And I was desperate back then to unload the manuscripts."
"You and I were never supposed to meet."
"That was the plan, wasn't it? You wired the money, I delivered the goods, then I disappeared again. Now I'm back."
Oscar cracked his knuckles and tried to stay calm.
"And Rybakov? Where is he now?"
"He's gone. He died a horrible death, Oscar. It was awful. But before he died, he gave me what I wanted. You."
"I don't have them."
"Fine. So what did you do with them?"
"Sold them. I flipped them as fast as possible."
"Where are they, Oscar?" "I'm going to find them, and the trail is already bloody."
"I don't know where they are, I swear."
"Then who has them?"
"Look, I need some time to think. You said you're patient, so just give me some time."
"Fair enough. I'll be back in 24 hours. And don't do anything stupid like try to run. There's no place to hide, and you'll get hurt if you try. We're pros, Oscar, and you don't have a clue."
"I'm not running.
24 hours, and I'll be back for the guy's name. Give me his name, and you get to keep your money and go on with your life. I'll never tell. You have my word.
Denny jumped to his feet and left the office. Oscar stared at the door and listened to his footsteps as he went down the stairs. He heard the door open, heard its little bell ring, then closed it quietly. Oscar put his face in his hands and tried not to cry. 4. 2 blocks away, Denny was in a hotel bar eating pizza when his cell phone rattled. It was almost 9 p.m. and the call was late.
Talk to me,
he said as he glanced around. The place was almost empty. Rooker said,
Mission accomplished. I caught Jacek in an elevator and had to slap him around. Quite fun, really. Delivered the message and all went well. Petrocelli was more of a problem because he worked late. About an hour ago, I caught him in the parking lot outside his office. Scared the shit out of him. A little wimp. At first, he denied representing Mark Driscoll, but he backed down quickly. Didn't have to hit him, but came close.
No witnesses?
None. Clean getaway with both.
Nice work. Where are you now?
Driving. I'll be there in 5 hours.
Hurry up. Tomorrow should be fun.
5. Rooker entered the bookshop at 6:05 and pretended to browse. There were no other customers. Oscar busied himself nervously behind the front counter but kept his eyes on the man. At 6, he said,
Sorry, sir, but we're closing.
At that moment, Denny entered, closed the door behind him, and flipped the open-closed sign. He looked at Oscar, pointed at Rooker, and said,
He's with me. Is anyone here?
Denny asked.
No. Everyone's gone.
Good. We'll just stay right here,
Denny said as he stepped toward Oscar. Rooker joined him, both within striking distance. They stared at him, and no one moved. Denny said,
Okay, Oscar. You've had some time to think. What's it gonna be?
You have to promise me you'll protect my identity.
I don't have to promise anything, Denny snarled. But I've already said no one will ever know. And what would I gain by revealing your involvement? I want the manuscripts, Oscar, nothing else. Tell me who you sold them to, and you'll never see me again. Lie to me, though, and you know I'll be back.
Oscar knew. Oscar believed. At that awful moment, the only thing he wanted was to safely get rid of this guy. He closed his eyes and said,
I sold them to a dealer named Bruce Cable. Owns a nice bookstore on Camino Island, Florida.
Denny smiled and asked,
How much did he pay?
$1 million.
Nice job, Oscar. Not a bad flip.
Would you please leave now?
Denny and Rooker glared at him without moving a muscle. For 10 long seconds, Oscar thought he was dead. His heart pounded as he tried to breathe. Then they left without another word. Chapter 6. The Fiction. 1. Entering Noelle's Provence was like walking into the middle of one of her handsome coffee table books. The front room was filled with rustic country furniture, armoires and dressers and sideboards and armchairs arranged comfortably on ancient stone tile flooring. The side tables were loaded with old jugs and pots and baskets. The plaster walls were peach-colored and adorned with sconces and smoky mirrors and dingy framed portraits of long-forgotten barons and their families. Scented candles emitted the thick aroma of vanilla. Chandeliers hung in clusters from the wood and plaster ceiling. An opera played softly in the background on hidden speakers. In a side room, Mercer admired a long, narrow wine-tasting table set for dinner, with plates and bowls of sun yellow and olive green, the basic colors of rustic Provençal tableware. Against the wall near the front window sat the writer's table, a beautiful, hand-painted piece that she was supposed to covet. According to Elaine, it was being offered for $3,000 and perfect for their needs. Mercer had studied all 4 of Noelle's books and easily identified the furniture and furnishings. She was admiring the writer's table when Noelle entered the room and said,
Well, hello, Mercer. What a nice surprise.
She greeted her with the casual French salute of obligatory pecks on both cheeks.
This place is gorgeous,
Mercer said, almost in awe.
Welcome to Provence. What brings you here?
Oh, nothing. Just browsing. I love this table, she said, touching the writer's table. There were at least three featured in her books.
I found it in a market in the village of Bonnieu, near Avignon. You should have it. It's perfect for what you do.
I need to sell some books first.
Come on, I'll show you around.
She took Mercer's hand and led her from one room to the next, all filled with furnishings straight from her books. They climbed an elegant staircase of white stone steps and wrought iron handrails to the second floor, where Noelle modestly showed off her inventory. More armoires and beds and dressers and tables, each with a story. She spoke so affectionately of her collection that she seemed reluctant to part with any of it. Mercer noted that not a single piece on the second floor had a price tag. Noelle had a small office downstairs in the rear of the store, and beside its door was a small flip-top wine tasting table. As she described it, Mercer wondered if all French tables were used for wine tasting.
Let's have some tea, Noelle said, and pointed to a chair at the table.
Mercer took a seat and they chatted as Noelle boiled water on a small stove next to a marble sink.
I adore that writer's table, Mercer said, but I'm afraid to ask its price.
Noelle smiled and said,
For you, dear, it has a special price. For anyone else, it's 3,000, but you can have it for half of that.
That's still a stretch. Let me think about it. Where are you writing now?
At a small breakfast table in the kitchen, with a view of the ocean, but it's not working. I'm not sure if it's the table or the ocean, but the words are not coming.
What's the book about?
I'm not sure. I'm trying to start a new one, but it's not going too well.
I just finished October Rain and think it's brilliant.
You're very kind.
Mercer was touched. Since coming to the island, she had now met three people who spoke highly of her first novel. More encouragement than she had received in the past 5 years. Noelle placed a porcelain tea service on the table and deftly poured boiling water into matching cups. Both added a cube of sugar but no milk, and as they stirred, Noelle asked,
Do you talk about your work?
I asked because most writers talk too much about what they've written or want to write, but a few find it difficult for some reason.
I prefer not to, especially about what I'm doing now. My first novel feels old and dated, like I wrote it many years ago. In many ways, it's a curse to get published so young. Expectations are high, the pressure is on, the literary world is waiting for some great body of work. Then a few years pass and there's no book. The promising star is slowly forgotten. After October Rain, my first agent advised me to hurry up and publish my second novel. She said that since the critics loved my first one, they would certainly hate my second. Whatever it was, so go ahead and get the sophomore jinx over with. Probably good advice, but the problem was I didn't have a second novel. I guess I'm still searching.
Searching for what?
A story.
Most writers say the people come first. Once they are on stage, they somehow find a plot. Not you?
Not yet. What inspired October Rain? When I was in college, I read a story about a missing child. One who was never found, and what it did to the family. It was an incredibly sad, haunting story, but also beautiful in many ways. I couldn't forget about it, so I borrowed the story, fictionalized it thoroughly, and wrote the novel in less than a year. That seems hard to believe now, working that fast. Back then, I looked forward to every morning, to the first cup of coffee and the next page. It's not happening now.
I'm sure it will. You're in the perfect place to do nothing but write.
We'll see.
Frankly, Noelle, I need to sell some books. I don't want to teach, and I don't want to find a job. I've even thought about writing under a pen name and cranking out mysteries or something that might sell.
There's nothing wrong with that.
Sell some books, and then you can write whatever you want.
That plan is slowly taking shape.
Have you thought about talking to Bruce?
No. Why would I?
He knows the business and the art from every angle. He reads everything, knows hundreds of writers and agents and editors, and they often come to him for his insights, not necessarily his advice.
He won't give any unless he's asked. He likes you, and he admires your work, and he would probably say something helpful.
Mercer shrugged as if the idea might have merit. The front door opened, and Noel said,
"Excuse me, but I may have a customer."
She left the table and disappeared. For a few moments, Mercer sipped her tea and felt like a fraud. She wasn't there to shop for furniture or chat about writing or pretend to be another lonely, troubled author trying to make friends. No. She was there snooping for any scrap of information she could hand over to Elaine, who might one day use it against Noel and Bruce. A sharp pain hit deep in her bowels as a wave of nausea swept over her. She endured it, waited for it to pass, then stood and steadied herself. She walked to the front of the store, where Noel was helping a customer who appeared to be serious about a dresser.
"I need to be going," Mercer said. "Of course," Noel said almost in a whisper. "Bruce and I would love to have you over for dinner soon."
"How lovely.
I'm free for the rest of the summer."
"I'll call."
2. Later in the afternoon, Noel was arranging a collection of small ceramic urns when a well-dressed couple in their 40s entered the store. Her first glance told her they were far more affluent than the average tourists who dropped in from the street, browsed long enough to understand the prices, then hustled away empty-handed. They introduced themselves as Luke and Carol Massey from Houston and said they were staying at the Ritz for a few days, their first visit to the island. They had heard about the store, had even seen its website, and were immediately attracted to a tile-top dining table that was 100 years old, and at that moment, the most expensive item in the store. Luke asked for a tape measure, and Noel handed one over. They measured the table from all directions, mumbling between themselves that it would be perfect in the guest house dining room. Luke rolled up his sleeves, and Carol asked if they could take photos. "Of course," Noel said. They measured 2 dressers and 2 large armoires, and in doing so asked intelligent questions about the wood, the finishes, the histories. They were building a new home in Houston and wanted it to look and feel like a Provençal farmhouse, one they had vacationed in the year before near the village of Roussillon in the Vaucluse. The longer they stayed, the more enamored they became with virtually everything Noel had to offer. She took them upstairs to the pricier furniture, and their interest intensified. After an hour in the store and at almost 5 p.m., Noel opened a bottle of champagne and poured 3 glasses. While Luke was measuring a leather chaise and Carol was snapping photos, Noel excused herself to go downstairs and check on the front. When 2 stragglers left, she locked the door and returned to the wealthy Texans. They gathered around an old comptoir and got down to business. Luke asked questions about shipping and storage. Their new home was at least 6 months away from completion, and they were using a warehouse to gather furniture and furnishings. Noel assured them that she shipped all over the country, and that was no problem. Carol clicked off the items she wanted to purchase at that moment, one of which was the writer's table. Noel said no, she was holding it for someone else, but she could easily find another one during her upcoming trip to Provence. They walked downstairs to her office, where she poured more champagne and began working on a bill. The total was $160,000, a figure that didn't faze them. Haggling over prices was part of the business, but the Masseys had no interest in it. Luke laid down a black credit card as if dealing in pocket change, and Carol signed the order. At the front door, they hugged her like old friends and said they might be back tomorrow. When they were gone, Noel tried to remember a sale of that magnitude. She could not. At 10:05 the next morning, Luke and Carol breezed back into the store with bright smiles and high energy. They said they'd spent half the night looking at photos and mentally moving pieces around their unfinished home, and, well, they wanted more. Their architect had emailed them scaled drawings of the first 2 levels, and they had sketched in designs and placements of where they wanted Noel's furniture. She couldn't help but notice that the house covered 19,000 square feet. They went to her second floor, spent the entire morning measuring beds, tables, chairs, and armoires, and in doing so, wiped out her inventory. The bill for the second day was over $300,000, and Luke again whipped out the black credit card. For lunch, Noel locked the store and took them to a popular bistro around the corner. While they ate, Her lawyer checked the validity of the credit card and learned that the Masseys could buy whatever they wanted. He also dug into their backgrounds but found little. Why did it matter? If the black card worked, who cared where the money came from? Over lunch, Carol asked Noel, "When will you get more inventory?" Noel laughed and said, "Well, obviously sooner rather than later. I was planning a trip to France in early August, but now that I have nothing to sell, I need to move it up." Carol glanced at Luke, who seemed a bit sheepish for some reason. He said,
"Just curious. We're wondering if perhaps we could meet you over there and shop together."
Carol added,
"We love Provence, and it would be a blast hunting for antiques with someone like you."
Luke said,
"We don't have kids and love to travel, especially to France, and we're really into these antiques. We're even looking for a new designer who could help with the flooring and wallpaper."
Noel said, "Well, I happen to know everyone in the business. When would you want to go?" The Masseys looked at each other as if trying to recall their busy schedules. Luke said,
"We're in London on business in 2 weeks. We could meet you in Provence after that."
"Is that too soon?"
Carol asked. Noel thought for a second and said,
"I can make it work. I go several times a year and even have an apartment in Avignon."
"Awesome,"
Carol said with great excitement.
"It will be an adventure. I can just see our home filled with stuff that we find ourselves in Provence."
Luke raised a wine glass and said,
"Here's to antiques hunting in the south of France."
3. 2 days later, the first truck was loaded with most of Noel's inventory. It left Camino Island bound for a warehouse in Houston where a large space was waiting. 1,000 square feet had been leased to Luke and Carol Massey. The bill, though, would eventually cross the desk of Elaine Shelby. In several months, when the project was over, for better or for worse, the lovely antiques would slowly re-enter the market. 4. At dusk, Mercer went to the beach, turned south, and drifted along at the water's edge. The Nelsons, from 4 doors to the south, stopped her for a quick chat as their mutt sniffed her ankles. They were in their 70s and held hands as they walked the beach. They were friendly to the point of being nosy, and had already extracted the reason for Mercer's little vacation.
"Happy riding," Mr. Nelson said as they left her.
A few minutes later, she was stopped by Mrs. Alderman from 8 doors to the north, who was walking her twin poodles and always seemed desperate for human contact. Mercer wasn't desperate, but she was enjoying the neighborhood. Almost to the pier, she left the water and approached a boardwalk. Elaine was back in town and wanted to meet. She was waiting on the small patio outside the triplex she had leased for the operation. Mercer had been there once before and seen no one but Elaine. If there were others involved in the surveillance, or if someone was shadowing her, she was unaware of it. Elaine had been vague when quizzed about it. They stepped into the kitchen, and Elaine asked,
"Would you like something to drink?"
"Water is fine."
"Have you had dinner?"
"No."
"Well, we can order a pizza, sushi, or Chinese takeout. What will it be?"
"I'm really not hungry."
"Neither am I."
"Let's sit here,"
Elaine said, pointing to a small breakfast table between the kitchen and the den. She opened the fridge and removed 2 bottles of water. Mercer took a seat and looked around.
"Are you staying here?"
she asked.
"Yes, for 2 nights.
Elaine sat across from her.
"Alone?"
"Yes. There's no one else on the island as of today. We come and go."
Mercer almost asked about the "we" part, but let it pass. Elaine said,
"So, you've seen Noel's store?"
Mercer nodded. Her nightly report by email was deliberately vague.
"Tell me about it. Describe the layout."
Mercer walked her through each display room, upstairs and down, adding as much detail as possible. Elaine listened carefully but did not take notes. It was obvious she knew a lot about the store.
"Is there a basement?" Elaine asked.
"Yes, she mentioned it in passing. She said she had a workshop down there, but had no interest in showing it to me."
"She's holding the writer's table. We tried to buy it, but she said it's not for sale. At some point soon, you're going to buy it, but perhaps you'll want it painted.
Perhaps you'll do this in the basement, and maybe you'll want to take a look to see a sample of the new color. We need to have a look in the basement because it adjoins the bookstores.
Who tried to buy it?
We. Us. The good guys, Mercer. You're not alone.
Why is this not comforting?
You're not being watched. We come and go, as I've said.
Okay. Suppose I get into her basement. Then what?
Look. Observe. Take it all in. If we're lucky, there might be a door that leads to the bookstore.
I doubt that.
I doubt it too, but we need to know. Is the wall concrete, brick, wood? We might need to go through it one day or night. What about the store's video surveillance?
Two cameras, one aimed at the front door, the other in the back, above the small kitchen area. There could be more, but I didn't see any. None on the second floor. I'm sure you already know this.
Yes, but in this business, we triple-check everything, and we never stop gathering information.
How was the front door locked? Deadbolt with a key. Nothing fancy.
Did you see a rear door?
No, but I didn't go all the way to the rear. I think there are some more rooms back there.
To the east is the bookstore. To the west is a realtor's office. Any door connecting to it?
None that I saw.
Nice work. You've been here 3 weeks, Mercer, and you've done a superb job of blending in and not arousing suspicion. You've met the right people, seen all you can see, and we're very pleased. But we need to make something happen.
I'm sure you have something up your sleeve.
Indeed.
Elaine walked to the sofa, picked up 3 books, and placed them in the center of the table.
Here's the story. Tessa left Memphis in 1985 and moved here for good. As we know, her will left her estate to her 3 children in equal shares. It had a provision leaving you $20,000 in cash for college. She had 6 other grandchildren, Connie, Holstead's bunch out in California, and Jane's only child, Sarah. You were the only one who got a specific bequest.
I was the only one she really loved.
Right, so our new story goes something like this. After she died, you and Connie were going through her personal items, the small stuff that's not mentioned in the will, and the 2 of you decided to divide it. A few items of clothing, some old photos, maybe some inexpensive art, whatever. Create the fiction you want. In the deal, you received a box of books, most of them kids' books Tessa had bought for you over the years. At the bottom, though, were these 3 books, all first editions from the public library in Memphis, all checked out by Tessa in 1985. When Tessa moved to the beach, she either intentionally or inadvertently brought these 3 books with her. 30 years later, you have them.
Are they valuable?
Yes and no. Look at the one on top.
Mercer picked it up. The Convict by James Lee Burke. It appeared to be in perfect condition, its dust jacket pristine and encased in mylar. Mercer opened it, turned to the copyright page, and saw the words, First Edition.
Elaine said, As you probably know, this was a collection of Burke's short stories that got a lot of attention in 1985. The critics loved it and it sold well.
What's it worth?
We bought this one last week for $5,000. The first printing was small and there aren't many of these left in circulation. On the back of the dust jacket, you'll see a barcode. That's what the Memphis Library was using in 1985, so the book is virtually unmarked. Of course, we added the barcode, and I'm sure Cable will know someone in the business who can remove it. It's not that difficult.
$5,000,
Mercer repeated, as if she were holding a gold brick.
Yes, and from a reputable dealer. The plan is for you to mention this book to Cable. Tell him its story, but don't show him the book, at least initially. You're not sure what to do. The book was obviously taken by Tessa, and she had no legitimate claim to it. Then it was taken by you, outside her estate, and so you have no legitimate claim to it. The book belongs to the library in Memphis, but after 30 years, who really cares? And, of course, you need the money.
We're making Tessa a thief?
It's fiction, Mercer.
I'm not sure I want to defame my deceased grandmother.
Deceased is the key word. Tessa's been dead for 11 years, and she didn't steal anything. The fiction you tell Cable will be heard by him only. Mercer slowly picked up the second book. Blood Meridian by Cormac McCarthy, published by Random House, 1985, a first edition with a shiny dust jacket. "What's this one worth?" she asked.
"We paid $4,000 a couple